Okay, it looks like a small group. My name's Richard Hurley. I'm just introducing the session 3G, developing a long-term care insurance market. And Sam Michael's going to start, and then Adam, no doubt, will be appearing very soon to take over. Over to you.
All right, very good. Okay, so thanks for coming along to this session. So this is work we've been doing. It's effectively based on US data and kind of in a US context as far as their long-term care insurance, but obviously there has been some discussion about the potential for long-term care market in Australia. Productivity Commission dismissed it, like they look at insurance and they realise that maybe it's not as good as it could be, and there are all sorts of problems. But anyway, we've had a closer look at this. Now this thing has decided not to work, so I'll use the key. So I'm going to introduce the talk, and then Adam's going to take over. I'll talk just a little bit about the modelling that we've used. It's kind of standard actuarial stuff, and we use, oh, here it is. Yeah, it works. So we use, to start with, a generic type of product and standard actuarial techniques. For more complicated products, we use simulation. Our transition rates and so on, we've estimated using US data, panel data, and then we have a look at a whole range of different factors. Demographic characteristics you'll see, very similar to what you expect even for Australia in terms of the age that people get severely disabled and how long they spend in disability, and then we look at premiums, reserves, and product design that make it more affordable in a sense. So it's a big issue not only in Australia. How do you fund long-term care costs? China are dealing with this as well. In the US at least, they do have long-term care insurance of a particular type based on paying a fixed amount rather than indemnity-based. Canada also has the French system's probably the best, maybe the best around, well-developed. Australia, we have basically nothing. I think there have been some attempts in the past to develop a product, and they've probably sold one or two policies, so obviously it's not a big seller, or hasn't been. Driving this, of course, is in Australia, a very good long-term care system at the moment. Cost of that's going to increase, and so the government has been looking at and thinking about, as they do always, with how to manage that cost. So our focus is kind of a hypothetical setup, where in the long term these products may become more used because of government budget pressures, for example. And it's been raised in Productivity Commission and a range of other areas as being one potential way to fund age costs. The typical products, they vary a lot, right? So in terms of the US market and other markets, they're related to or use exactly activities of daily living. So it depends on how many activities of daily living you can actually do, and the fewer of these that you can do, the more disabled you are. So typically, if you look at the products in the US, it's either you can't perform two or three out of six activities of daily living typically. So this is dressing, walking, bathing, eating, transferring, toileting, so on. So this is in Australia, I guess when they do the assessments, they use other factors, but it's driven a lot by these ADLs. They call it core activity restrictions in the data for the ABS. And you can get data. We haven't looked at the Australian data. The IHW have data around ADLs, five ADLs, very similar to the ones, for example, you see in the US insurance market. But we're driven by the US data that we have available, and I suspect the transition rates that you estimate would be similar in Australia. Individuals generally get sick in a similar way and have similar failings. So the long-term care insurance, there's lots of different designs. So they range from fixed benefit policies where you get $400 a week, $100 a week, fixed amounts if you're in a particular state of disability, health, severe ill health. There are also policies that pay fixed amounts when you enter a long-term care facility, for example. Yeah, there are indemnity-based policies, but maybe not as popular, based on the costs of your health coverage. And then there are some that allow you to choose between these types of benefits. When we do our analysis, we have something we call a generic policy. So this is just a plain, ordinary policy. We can price this with standard kinds of actuarial techniques. And then we add in some other features that make these products handle issues around product design, elimination period, for example, so how long you have to wait till you get paid a benefit, and a maximum benefit period obviously reduces the cost significantly if you can add in these features. And these features require, in our case, simulation to compute premiums and reserves. We also look at policies being combined with other types of insurance. So we look at standalone policies, but for example, if you want to leave a bequest, one way to do that is to buy a life insurance policy. Right now you know exactly what you're going to leave behind. I want to leave $500,000 when I die to my kids. I buy a $500,000 life insurance policy. So why not tag on a benefit, long-term care benefit, as a rider benefit to that? So this is one possibility. Obviously, the older ages when you're buying this life insurance, very expensive, so it's probably not a practical option, but we will show those costs. The other thing that's become much more promoted in some sense, particularly in the US, is the idea of a life care annuity, where if you have an annuity market — we don't have one in Australia — but if you had a life annuity market, you could add on to a life annuity this additional benefit when you enter some level of care required, right? So you have a rider, you get so much as long as you're alive and healthy. When you become disabled or ill health, you get a higher amount to cover your costs of getting care in your home or moving into a care facility, for example. So we also have a look at these, and these are much more viable. The cost relative to the cost of annuity makes the long-term care insurance look more affordable. And there's the potential for offsets between the mortality in the annuity and the health costs in the long-term care. Yeah, so our focus is on looking at pricing and reserves. We also look at solvency capital. We use the European Solvency II, so they have these specific shocks you have to make to mortality and transition probabilities. So we look at what those solvency requirements would be and how they vary for these products. And then we look at costs and trying to make them more cost-effective using things like elimination periods, maximum benefit periods. And we look at sales of products to different cohorts, to individuals who are already in requiring some form of long-term care, so obviously their mortality and experience is different across those different states that you might sell, rather than just selling to healthy individuals. So our standard approach is what all good actuaries are aware of, at least I guess if they've studied actuarial course in the last 15 years. Probably before that, actuaries also studied these. So it's a multiple state model, Markov transitions. So we have a healthy state, we have a mildly disabled state, and a severely disabled state. Mildly disabled, 1 to 2 ADLs, you don't get a benefit. Severely disabled, you do, 3 to 6 ADLs. And you can change the 2 and 3, you can change the definition of severely disabled. Obviously impacts costs. We have some slides at the end on that. We may not get to them. And the last, on your way to dying, you go through these different states potentially. But you can also die out of a healthy state as well. So this is the wonderful mathematics that you're not interested in. But the estimation — we have a separate paper, it's just come out in North American Actuarial Journal, where we estimate the transition rates. So we use a large panel database in the US. It's the Health and Retirement Study, so they've been collecting over the last 14 years, doing a survey across a range of individuals of different ages, and they go out every 2 years and they do a survey on their health status, all the things that you need, all the information you need about their health and income and lots of interesting stuff. And so we've used that to estimate transition rates between health states and mortality rates in different states: healthy, mildly disabled, severely disabled. And that's reported in another paper that has just appeared in the North American Actuarial Journal. And this is what I've just mentioned. So there's a new wave has just come out. So we've got 14 years. This is based on what was available when we were doing this study. It's designed to be representative survey. It's very hard to get this kind of data from the government records because you can't keep anonymity, right? So as soon as you start, so they get all concerned. It's the same in Australia. It's very hard to get this kind of data. So they do surveys. We're trying to actually get a survey like this going in Australia, but it's not so easy. So it's longitudinal. We have lots of information. We use health status, self-reported, not responded, but self-reported health status, so we know about their ADLs. We also have their cognition, so we have an indicator of cognition, which is also sometimes used in these policies, and it's related to memory and mental status, so they go and interview the person, see if they remember what they did 5 minutes ago and things like that. So there's 19,500 individuals, a bit over half females without the cognition, and 18,000 with the cognition in terms of the number of lives. And then to do pricing, the standard approach these days is model the dynamics and solve the dynamics for values, and that's what we do here. I won't go into the detail. More complicated products, you need to use simulation, so we use simulation, but we use the same estimated rates. In fact, we'll show some results where we've just assumed 40,000 males, 40,000 females. We've simulated their life course, and based on that, we've estimated benefit payments, standard errors, reserves, value at risk, all those kinds of things. Solvency, so we include solvency, and the concept is things that you're familiar with. Hold enough capital so you can withstand a 1 in 200 event, right? And in how that's implemented in practice is based on a shock, right? So you calculate your net reserve or net asset value, allowing for a shock. And because in the disability product we have a longevity shock and a disability shock, we have to include both. And the longevity shock is a 20% decrease in mortality rates at all ages. And the disability shock is an increase of 35% in disability rates at all ages for the next year, then a permanent increase of 25% at all ages for the following years, and a decrease in recovery rates, because recovery rates are important, of 20%. And then you assume basically those things are all independent and you compute a capital requirement. And then to get your... So you have a capital requirement. On top of that, there's a risk margin, which is kind of getting the fair value of your liabilities, and this is how it's computed in the Solvency II standard formula. You allow for your solvency capital ratios as you run the business off, and there's a cost of capital applied to that, and then you discount all that back, and that gives you your risk margin that you add on top of your solvency margin to get the total capital requirement, which is this guy here. And we also compute capital ratios, so you just take the total capital requirement as a percentage of the value of your liability. And now I will hand it over to Adam.
Thank you, Mike. So for now, let's focus on this ratio, and later I'll show results about this capital requirement ratio to compare across different types of products and so to different cohorts. First, based on the simulated data, because we simulate a cohort of 40,000 males and a cohort of 40,000 females, and we assume they're all 65 years old and healthy at the outset, and we see how these cohorts would, what are the health trajectories for these cohorts would be. So that's from age 65, we see that for males, the mildly disabled males would increase significantly. And compared to that, the severely disabled males would increase but at a smaller rate, and the peak for severely disabled ones will come always later than the mildly disabled for males and females. It's the same pattern. And we see after a certain age, the number of severely disabled will be more than the number of mildly disabled. But this crossover age is later for male compared to female. And also, as we can see, the first glance when you look at this picture, you might wonder why. You can see that the number of disabled ones for females are much larger than their male counterparts, regardless of mildly disabled or severely disabled. And that's just a figure that we can look at the health trajectories. And then we look at some figures, some numbers we want to show what some important demographic characteristics based on these simulated cohorts. We'll first look at the mean years of life after age 65, also called the residual life expectancy at age 65. We can see for males, compared to males and females, females tend to have more than 3 years longer life expectancy after age 65. And we also look at the mean years with disability, the number of the expected time spent in disability, in mild disability and severe disability. And we see that the longer 3 years that females live compared to their males, and one of the 3 years is spent in mild disability, and another nearly 1 year spent in severe disability. The remaining more than 1 year is spent in healthy. So although females live longer, they tend to suffer longer as well. And we also look at the proportion of people that ever become disabled. And we found this proportion is very high for males and females. And of course, the females tend to have higher proportion. And if we look at the proportion with mild disability or with severe disability, we also see that the increase for females compared to their males is around 15%. We are also interested in the average age of first disability, given that he or she ever become disabled. We find that this age is quite similar for males and females. But if we look at the average of first mild disability condition of becoming mildly disabled, we would find the females tend to have around 0.8 years later. The onset age will be later for females compared to males. And this difference becomes much larger if we look at the severe disability. So for severe disability, the males and females tend to have more different features. That's about the demographic characteristics. Then we look at the premiums we calculated. Let's start from the standalone policies using the TLS differential equation method. If we compare across males and females, of course we see that females tend to have higher premiums because they tend to have higher disability rate and also they have lower mortality rates. So longer durations in disability are expected for females. That's why the expenses will be much higher. And also if we compare across different ages, we would see a pattern that is increasing for the healthy ones, increasing with ages. But for the disabled ones, this pattern doesn't always hold. It can be increased for a certain age and then decrease because then they tend to die faster. So the expected duration spent in disability becomes shorter. So for these costs, they have two competing risks, two risks. They're opposite each other. That is the disability risk. And also that is the mortality risk. For this policy, we assume if the person becomes severely disabled, we would pay $100 per day as long as the person is in a severely disabled state. $100 per day would amount to around $36,000, which is also the assumed average care cost in the residential care in the Productivity Committee report. I also assume the continuously compounded interest rate is 4% per annum. We use the same parameters and the setup, and let's look at the policy premiums for rider benefit policies and also life care annuities. If you look at the rider benefit policies and if we compare for the rider benefit policy across different ages, we would see this is increasing all the time. This is because in the rider benefit policies, mortality becomes more important because we have a life insurance, right? So that's why it's becoming more and more expensive. And if you compare males and females, we find that males, the premiums for males are more expensive than females. That's also because the mortality part becomes more important in these policies. And for life care annuities, we assume we would pay $50 per day as long as the person is alive. But when the person becomes severely disabled, we pay $100 in total per day. When we assume $50 per day, this also amounts to $18,000, which is the assumed average residential accommodation charges in the productivity report, commission report. And if you look at the results for life care annuities and compare to males to females, and females are much will be larger, and that's because the annuity component, also females live longer. That's why it's also more expensive. And the difference I expect to be even larger compared to standalone policies. And this decreases across age for life care annuities, but it's because as people get older, the remaining life expectancy is lower. So that's because the annuity component is a very large component in life care annuities. And also if we compare across different health states, this is for the life care annuities issued to healthy individuals and life care annuities issued to mildly disabled individuals and issued to severely disabled individuals. We find this is getting more expensive. This is getting more expensive for the healthy ones and also for the severely disabled ones. But for the mildly disabled ones, their prices are not necessarily very expensive. That's because the counter effects of disability risk and also longevity risk, the mortality risk. And also based on the life care annuity premiums, we can calculate, based on the life care annuities and also standalone policies, we can calculate the annuity value and annuity factor to have a comparison with other standard studies. We find these other annuity factors, which decrease across age, consistent. We also include other product features that include inflation protection, that is, the benefits increase at the inflation rate. And for simplicity, we just assume inflation rate is 3% per annum and it's continuously compounded. And the interest rate is the same, still at 4%. And then we would find, if we include inflation protection, and if we not, then we compare the increase in the prices. We find it's the most for standalone policies. It's very substantial, and also a bit more for female. Because females tend to live longer, so the accumulation of inflation, the effect of this accumulation of inflation would be larger. And if compared to other policies, the rider benefit policies and life care annuities, the effect is not that important. That's because the inflation only affects the annuity part and the disability, the long-term care benefits part. But for the death benefit, it doesn't affect. So that's why the effect is very minimal. We also look at other typical product features, including the elimination period and the maximum benefit period. What is elimination period? It's something similar to the waiting period in the disability insurance. That is, for example, if there is a 30-day elimination period, so if the person becomes disabled, and then for the first 30 days, the person gets nothing, the individual gets nothing from the insurer, but after the 30-day period, after the elimination period, the policy will start to pay the long-term care benefits. And the maximum benefit period is the maximum periods of benefits paid to the individual, as the name suggests. It's very intuitive. If we just look at the different elimination period, we find, of course, the longer the elimination period, the lower the premium. But what we want to see is if this is significant, if the product features are very effective in making the policies more affordable. We found not so much difference, only 2,000 difference for males. And also if you look at the maximum benefit period compared to the unlimited and the 3-year maximum benefit period, we find there's substantial reduction in the premium. So we can say the maximum benefit period is very effective in making the products more affordable. And also if we later will look at whether these product features are effective in controlling for extreme risks or idiosyncratic risk. We also find that the maximum benefit period are very effective in controlling for idiosyncratic risk. We'll see that later. And here we also include a different types of policy. That's called shared long-term care insurance. It's typically sold to couples. This policy allows each person to access his or her spouse benefits. For separate policies, if separately 3 maximum year benefit, then each person has maximum 3-year benefit. But if we have a shared long-term care insurance, so each one has potential to claim double number of maximum benefit periods. So it's like putting the two separate products together. And then if we look at the results for illustrative purposes, for a couple of male and female, both aged 65, and if they have 3-year maximum benefit period policies separately, if they put it separately, the total premium should be around this much. If they purchase a shared policy with 3-year maximum benefit policy, then the expected premium would be much higher. This is much higher because they have access to longer maximum benefit periods. And also the rationale for this policy is the probability of both couples having a very long period of disability is small, typically small. So that's why if you purchase 6-year separate policies, it's unnecessary. And then we look at the best estimate reserves for standalone policies. We see that the reserves for the healthy is increasing and decreasing again. The increase in part is just due to the interest accrual, and then decreasing because people die out. And this effect becomes larger for policies sold to the severely disabled individuals. It's pretty standard results, consistent with simple products. And then we want to estimate the effect of idiosyncratic risk. So we use the VAR, value at risk. And if you look at the VAR, different levels of VAR, and compared to the best estimate reserve, we find it's very large. Although we have very large proportion, 40,000 males and 40,000 females. For the females figure, it will show a similar pattern. And then how we assess it quantitatively, we use this quantity. That is the difference between the VAR at a level of 99.5% and the best estimate reserve divided by the best estimate reserve. Then we use this to assess how large the idiosyncratic risk is for different types of policies. For the generic policies, compared with different elimination periods, we find they don't change much. The elimination period doesn't change much the idiosyncratic risk. And previously we have shown that the elimination period doesn't change much in the premium as well. And if you look at the maximum benefit period, they do matter. They somehow changes the patterns of this quantity. So that's why we say the maximum benefit periods are effective in controlling for idiosyncratic risk. And we also compare the solvency capital ratios, as what Mike just have shown how to calculate the ratio here. We compare this ratio across different types of policies. We first look at how the ratios would change for standard policies standalone policies sold to different cohorts. For the healthy one, it's here. It's this solid line for males and females. And for the mild ones, it's dotted line. And for severely disabled ones, it's here. It's even lower. So the capital requirement is even lower for policies sold to disabled individuals. But typically in the market, policies are only sold to the healthy individuals. These results provide motivations for the insurability of the severely disabled individuals, as well as the moderately disabled individuals. So it would benefit the company as well as the individuals to have this market to allow the disabled individuals to purchase long-term care insurance. And also if we compare the ratios across different products, the standalone policies, rider benefit and life care annuities, we find for the standalone policies, it's a solid line. The capital ratio is very high. And if we compare across for other two types of policies, we find the rider benefit policy would have very low capital requirement ratio. And also the life care annuities would have low ratio as well, very reasonable ratios. So these provide motivations for providing to combining standalone policies with life care, with life insurance and annuities. After we look at the aggregate, the solvency capital requirements, we want to have a look at what are the capital requirements for different shocks. Remember, we have two shocks, longevity shock and disability shock. So for the longevity shock, we find it's almost negative. That means it doesn't change. For the rider benefit policies, we do not have to increase our capital requirement when we have longevity shock, because the longer the people live, it's a good thing for life insurance providers, right? And that's why this is negative. And for the disability, it's positive in the first few years, because the more likely the people get disabled, the expensive, the premiums will be higher for the long-term care component. If you look at the life care annuities, we find the long-term care, the longevity component will dominate the disability shock, because the life care, the annuity part is more important in life care annuities. So those are the major results we would like to present. Now here's time to wrap up the presentation. So we used the Tillis-Dinfield equations and simulation-based approach. Used two approaches to calculate the premiums and also the best estimate reserves. And then we assessed the solvency capital requirements based on the Solvency II standard formula. We do not develop an internal model. We just look at the standard formula. And also we look at the product designs for different types of policies and also the product features which are effective or not in what they are designed for. Our results suggest that there is a potential market to underwrite disabled individuals. This would benefit both sides. And the maximum benefit period is found to be very effective in making the policies more affordable and also reducing the idiosyncratic risk. In the appendix, we have shown a sensitive analysis that is if we change the definition for severe disability, that is the state where the long-term care benefits would be paid out to the individuals. And these are the sensitive analysis results. Because for different policies, they might have different definitions. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Adam. That's clearly some very good technical underpinnings of what it might mean to get a long-term care market in Australia. I might kick off with a question, if I may. Do you have any thoughts on what it might take to ensure that there would be accessibility to disabled people as well to such policies? What you could do to the product design to try to facilitate access to all?
just sell the products to them. I don't know what the practical procedures we could take to allow these people to purchase, but we could, because what I understand is there is adverse selection behind this, right? Although I have shown that the elimination period is not effective in making the products more affordable or in controlling for the idiosyncratic risk, but they're important in controlling for the adverse selection problem. So if you want to issue those products to disabled individuals, I think the elimination period will be also important in that case to have a look at. Yeah. Thanks.
Hi, Gary Kemka again. So one comment first up is recently Harry Anto published some papers on estimating the transition probabilities for Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 4 disabled states. So there is some work very recently published.
Yeah, I saw that paper as well. It's from Melbourne University, right?
Yes, he was
there. They use Australian data, but it's cross-sectional data. What we use here is cross-sectional. That is, but here, our data from the US, this data is panel data. So we track each individual across, like, we have 12 years observations. So this data would be better. But in that paper, they have developed approximate methods to deal with cross-sectional data. It's also interesting. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, no, I've used that data, so at least there is something in Australia.
Yep. Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah.
So going back to slide 15. Next one, maybe.
This one, yep. Yeah.
So do you have any understanding why females have such higher rates of incidence?
Why they have such higher rates?
Than males. Yeah, incidence of disabled.
There'd be more females. That's what I should. There'd be more females in that population.
No, they were actually the same number of population. 40,000 males.
By the time they get to 70, there'd be more females graduates.
Yeah, that can. The survival rate is lower for males as well. Yes, we have more females, but also another thing is the disability rate is much higher for males. We have shown the disability rates. Compare that with male and female. Females have higher disability rates than males. It's the major risk.
I always assume that, because I've come from a health background, that males get looked after more than females.
That's possible.
And so you tend to find that you might not see males disabled in the data, because when females become disabled at those ages, they need help, while males have help in a traditional family model of Australia.
Okay.
Qualitative.
It's one possible explanation. It's actually a very heated topic. People try to explain what's the difference between males and females. Some would say it's just a gene things, and also lifestyle things as well.
So now going back to the second last slide.
Okay, second last. This one or?
Next.
This one.
So yep. Given that the red line crosses down below the blue line. The disabled.
Yeah.
Yeah. So given that females live longer, they have higher incidence rates.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain why that behavior happens?
Oh, this why they cross over.
And females actually have less capital requirements than males.
Oh, here is about the disability shocks. That is, if we increase the disability rate and reduce the recovery rate at the same time. And then how much more capital should be required, right? Then for males, so females would have higher because I think it's because the disability rate here is the major effect compared to the recovery effect. So that's why female would be higher. But later, then the recovery rate will be higher. Recovery rate become an important factor, actually, as we have shown in, we didn't show the rates here. Actually, we would find for males, the recovery rate is just decreasing, but for females, it's kind of a hump-shaped. So first increasing after around age 75 and then decreases. That's from a different paper in NIJ. I think that's the possible reason why there's a crossover here. Thanks. Yes. Okay.
Soon from PwC. Just to add on to ask on the rider and the standalone. I was not clear. Can you explain again why the rider benefit has a lower capital requirement than the standalone?
Why here? The rider benefit. Yep. Actually, the results for the rider benefit is not very confirming. It's not very confirming because for the rider benefit policies, it's actually combined long-term care benefits, long-term care, standalone long-term care insurance with life insurance, right? And we shock the longevity. We shock longevity shock. But actually, longevity shock in terms of life policy, they are not shock. It's a good thing. They won't have higher capital requirements for life insurers, right? So that's why this will be reduced substantially. But for disability risk, of course, it will shock. It will increase their capital requirements. But in the rider benefit policy, as we said, a larger component is life insurance, right? For life insurance, longevity risk will reduce the capital requirement instead of increase the capital requirements. So that's why the rate is very low. Yes.
Hi, sorry, just two real dumb questions. Aaron here from ANU. With Solvency II, can you remind me for the capital requirement for a longevity shock? Is that an immediate and permanent reduction of 20% in mortality?
It's permanent.
And it applies immediately, does it? Okay.
So it's immediately and permanent, yeah. That's okay, right. Okay. Yep, here is the longevity risk. Permanent 20% increase at all ages.
Okay. Another dumb question. The benefit you've got of $100 per day, do you know if that's actually sufficient to pay for what it needs to pay for in the Australian context, or don't know?
We are not sure if it's sufficient, but we base this on this assumption in the productivity report.
So that's been benchmarked as a reasonable benefit?
It's reasonable. Many policies, they provide this.
Is that for aged care at home, or is that for at-home care? Don't know.
For either types.
Either type, okay.
As long as you meet the requirement, that's two or more, or three or more ADLs difficulties. We don't care if it's home care or long-term care facilities.
Okay, do you know what home care facilities cost, though, or don't know?
We don't know the costs.
Okay, that's right. Thanks.
Yes.
Adrian Forsky here. I assume you're not allowing for lapses from the product when you scenarios?
No, we don't allow for that.
And just a quick question.
Yep.
Because obviously these numbers are quite high. Where do you sort of see the insurance need, or do you have any comment on how the government obviously funds insurance to some degree. How do you feel like when you've got out your numbers, does it match? What does it match the need? Do you have any comments on those kind of things?
That's a good question to think about. I think that's a good comment, yeah. Thanks.
Jeff Austin, Common Shore. Two questions.
Yep.
One for Mike to start with. You mentioned at the start that the Productivity Commission dismissed, if you like, long-term care. I can't remember your exact words. So I wouldn't mind you just giving a very brief summary of the what and the why in terms of what they said, because this is a new area for me. And the second question, which is very different, I'm still trying to get my mind around the capital requirements for this sort of business. For instance, if I take mortgage insurance, a large percentage of the premium for mortgage insurance actually goes to the cost of capital. It's probably the biggest cost. So I'm trying to get a sense of, if you had a portfolio of this sort of business, what percentage of the premium do you think would be cost of capital? Is it 10% of a premium, 20% of a premium, 50% of a premium? How much is going in a normal portfolio of long-term care to cover the cost of capital as opposed to the underlying risk, basically? Mm-hmm. So is that really saying in that graph that for healthy lives at younger ages, almost all of the premiums going to cover Because that's the amount of capital, right? Not the cost of capital, is that right? As a ratio of the premiums?
Yeah. It's the amount of capital, yeah.
The amount of capital. So.
But this, if at time zero, this will be the premium, isn't it? And then this ratio will be the reciprocal of what you are asking. That's the amount of capital that go into, the amount of premium that go into the capital requirements. So we do have that, but we didn't show that specifically.
So you'd have to apply the cost of capital to the total capital requirement. And that would be the component you'd have to charge for cost of capital if you were to do that.
Well, for the first question.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Significant. You see the reserves are quite significant. And if your first question, basically, we know insurance markets have all these adverse selection, moral hazard type problems, and if you read the Productivity Commission report, they said, oh, two of the solutions for the aged care is first mortgages using your house or a viable long-term care insurance market. And they more or less said because insurance markets have all these problems, then that's probably not the way to go. Basically, they said insurance is a market failure, particularly in this type of insurance. And that was the argument.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're out of time. Just like to say thank you again to Michael and Adam, and it was a small gift.